And so good evening. So Tweri's been taking these last few months from I think February through most of this month, and I'm filling in for a couple of talks this month, but then we'll continue on for the rest of the year. And the framing that we're using for this whole year is the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering, there's a cause of that suffering, origination of that suffering, and the cessation of the suffering. And there's also the path leading to the end of that suffering. So right in the middle of the Eightfold Path, focusing on wise livelihood this month. Now, wise livelihood, as we've talked about the last couple talks, Tweri, in the beginning of the month, and I talked a couple weeks ago, we looked at how wise livelihood revolves around non-harm. That our ways that we make a living, the way that we are in the world, doesn't cause harm in that. It's based in ethics. But tonight I'd like to take that a step further into some of the more subtle ways of wise livelihood, how we can start to make our very daily life a spiritual practice. How do we actually do that? And we can see that the Four Noble Truths come in nicely into informing that. I know some of you in the room may be retired or may not be working or may be working at home, whatever it might be, to try to expand this beyond just work to how you spend your day, you know, how you interact with others, whether you're caring for someone else, for yourself, whatever that might be. And in particular, I like to focus on three common patterns that people bring forth around struggles with work. Okay, conflicts. I mean, conflict with coworkers, with bosses, with people you supervise. A sense of stress at work, the difficulty of being overworked, and also boredom. Boredom. So we use those three aspects as a way to start to use livelihood as a spiritual practice. Now, with these problems that we may have, these very real nitty-gritty problems we struggle with at work, the Dharma is not about giving you answers. It's not about some outside authority saying, oh, you should do choice A instead of choice B. It's much more about teaching you how to see for yourself, how to have a clarity of mind to see in your own experience, in your own wisdom, what is the right choice, the right decision. And so it puts it back on you. We're just trying to give you the skills to see clearly and to see in a particular framework of the Four Noble Truths. What leads to suffering? What leads to the end of suffering? It can be as simple as that with every choice, every moment of decision. So these three areas, starting with conflicts at work, the struggles, those rubs we have as human beings with each other. So looking from the lens of the Four Noble Truths, when we have a conflict with someone else, if we look carefully, we see that it's actually an expression of tanha. Tanhas. For those of you who perhaps remember back to the Second Noble Truth, that is the origination of dukkha. Revolving around this word tanha, this thirst, this hunger. Particularly this hunger to be, to not be, and also the hunger around sense pleasures. So this expression of tanha, of thirst, of, you can think of it as this basic unrest. That the moment's not quite right. I'm not quite right. I'm seeking something better, something different, more of, less than. So as we have that hunger, that provides the seeds for dukkha, for suffering to start to manifest, to arise. And conflicts, if you look at it in, from a dharmic lens, it actually shows us that's a gateway into the Four Noble Truths. Right, he takes it from being this abstract list, this thing that the Buddha talked about 2,600 years ago, to something we actually see showing up day in and day out in our lives, in our work. I think that's one of the beauties of this Eightfold Path, is that the Buddha was very comprehensive in his teaching. You know, the places we might hide, like, okay, I'm going to be a good meditator, I'm going to have deep concentration. But he said, well, how are you at work? How are you when you are talking to people, when your actions? So you have to include all this whole expression of being a human being into the path. It can't be just isolated into something that you do for 20 minutes, 30 minutes a day. It has to start to meld into your life. So many of us are, that's really becoming how we were seeing life. That we can't see, we can't separate those out. Our understanding has grown deep enough that we can't live in denial of what we've seen in the cushion. Other ones of us are learning that. It's starting to naturally grow and to see. So wherever we are in this process, whether we're just learning how to connect with our breath and our bodies, or we're starting to see some deeper understanding emerging from that, we can take this Eightfold Path as a practice model. So back to the sense of conflict. So when conflict arises, it's actually this gateway into tanha, into the very specific way that thirst is operating in you. The very specific way it's manifesting based on your conditioning, your history, you know, your environment, all these different factors come together in how what you find is something that's a conflict versus not. Now, so often when a conflict arises, our normal way of working with it is to try to fix the other, to fix the external. Right? If I can just get rid of that person or that situation, I'll be happy. I'll be at peace, right? Now the Dharma says, okay, let's pause for a moment. Instead of going into getting rid of that, first see what is the trigger in yourself. If you kind of get the knack of doing that, going into the internal trigger, that provides the gateway, the door opens into the Dharma. Because that conflict shows you how you're manifesting, how you're gripped in that moment. This is the internal freedom that's not dependent upon the external. The normal way is to fix the external, but then we're always dependent upon the external being a certain way. But where can this freedom be based in our internal experience? Then it becomes free of the external circumstances. Even more specifically, when that conflict arises, if you listen carefully, if you look carefully, we can see what are we believing about ourselves? What aspect of ourselves are we holding so clear, so dear? Can you have a conflict? Can you have an argument with someone else without having a strong opinion in yourself? I'm right, you're wrong. Right? That sense of I'm being right, that is what we try to examine. It could be that we are right. But we learning to see that sense of the tanha, that sense of unconscious forming around that, that provides the gateway into the Dharma. So as a Dharma practitioner, it's very helpful to practice kind of suspending the other, suspending what they're doing wrong, how they're not seeing the big picture, and how I'm so right, to suspend the details of the conflict. And to go instead into this sense of embodiment, to see where this is in the body, where is it showing up in the body. So it's a complete ownership of your experience. You know, like in therapy, often one of the first things someone learns is instead of saying, you made me mad, to say, I'm mad, I'm feeling angry. That's in a sense of ownership. And it's so tricky, it's so, we hide from ourselves, we delude ourselves. And this being said, as we journey into this quality of investigation, And have no illusions that this will magically fix everything. That there often, as we get clearer about ourselves, our own involvement, from that point of clarity, that's how we act from that. And we may have some very difficult conversations, interactions, as we sort through these conflicts. We have to have this discernment to see which way to go. So as conflict arises, I'm inviting us to use it as a chance for investigation. What I mean by investigation is a way of using the steadiness of attention, the penetrating awareness, to see really what is going on in this moment in my own experience. It's like taking that light of mindfulness, maybe focusing on the breath and the body that's cultivated a steadiness, and learning to turn it on this very conflict. And it's hard to do this process of investigation in the middle of an argument. It's so charged, you don't know what to say. So often we do this after the moment. We go through the echoes of that, the residue of that. And in that, going through that, we start to have more clarity. The next time that conflict arises, we start to be able to come more and more in present time how to meet that. Now, one of the trouble with investigation is that often we think too much with it. We get so caught up in the thinking, in the conceptual part. We try to find our way through the tangle, but we don't realize we're using the very tangle itself to sort it through. I remember my nephew, he was probably around 4 or so, and for some reason he had these 3 balloons, and he was running around the house, and they were getting more and more tangled. He was trying to get them untangled by running faster, right? And it wasn't working. You know, he came to me with this big tangle, and I'm like trying to, you know, undo it. I would get it mostly done, and he would go run and tangle it up some more, all right? And that's often how I think we are in our minds, that we have this tangle in our thoughts and our beliefs and our opinions, our fears, our worries that we carry with us. And we try to figure it out by running and thinking more, just like my nephew, when the tangle gets more and more intense, more intractable. So you don't realize that our very thinking is already caught, is already distorted. So luckily we have a whole nother mode. We can actually go from thinking into this body, into what is this body feeling like in this moment. Because any conflict that you have, any difficulty, any experience, joyful or painful, has its body expression. And if you can learn to reorient into the body and feeling, where is this felt in the body? What's the expression of this in the body right in this moment? Right? That provides a quality of grounding. And if you practice meeting it with relaxation, with openness, with tenderness, some of the most painful things can start to unwind. If you go into the world of thought and belief and emotion, it can be so caught, so almost endless. As we think about it more, and we become more upset. But coming into the body, we start to have a coolness that comes through, a calmness, a groundedness that comes through with meeting that in this body. And focusing on relaxing the body is so helpful. Often when we go into the body at first, we encounter the tension that's been built up over years. The tension of the fear of who we are in the world and how the world relates to us. Right? So learning how can I relax that? How can I let that start to relax and drain into the earth? So having a sense of verticality can be very helpful with this. One teacher described it as like if you're coming out of being frostbit, one of the most painful things is when you start to thaw, right? So you develop this capacity to hold that discomfort in the body, letting that thaw as you open. And trusting that relating to the body, connecting with the body, will translate into the mind relaxing, the psychic, the emotional, the mental, to start to soften. And as we do this process, you know, this conflict. So hopefully you get a sense. I got really upset with my coworker, with my boss, with my partner, whoever it might be. That sense of conflict, instead of going into the story around it, the ideas around it, what they did wrong and how I'm right, okay, where is this in the body? Even more simply, what is the body feeling like in this moment? What is the, you know, just coming to it and resting, noticing any areas of tension, letting that relax and soften. And as we do that, it can be very helpful to float a question. What am I denying in this moment? What am I denying? And as you hold that, you often will see these deeper roots. Okay, maybe my arrogance, my lust, the things that we deeply judge about ourselves. They start to reveal themselves. And we feel that in the body. And so the conflict finds this gateway, this entry point into this deeper quality in the body. This is coming into the deeper quality of tanha, of thirst, of the thirst to be, to become, the thirst to not be, to not become. So it's a very tangible way to start to understand the Four Noble Truths, particularly the second, the origination of dukkha. So what is being denied? And then just opening with tenderness to that sense of gentleness. Let me hear this denied truth. From that point, a clarity arises. And then the conflict, okay, I need to talk to this person, or I need to let this go. Instead of the reaction, the reactivity, trying to go from that tangle of balloons to find your way through it. Now when you touch into the truth, these deeper truths, if it's truly something that's true, there's a stillness that comes from that. There's a quiet that emerges with that. If you go into the story around it, it leads to more thought, more elaboration. When you touch something that's true, you naturally become a little stiller inside, a little quieter inside. There's like that resonance, that sense of knowing. Okay. When you feel that, then okay, I can relax into that. You start to trust that more and more, much more than the tangle of balloons of thought, of story and worry. And in that stillness, part of the energy that propels tanha, that propels our suffering, releases, begins to quiet, to become more still. If you really follow this process, you may find this sense of, do I really want to be peaceful? Do I really want to release this deep sense of thirst? Because if I release that, what am I? What am I? What's all my strategies of life start to become in question? Are we willing to be at peace? So conflict is this gateway into seeing tanha. Now moving into this sense of stress and overwork, I think many of us do feel that sense of having too much to do, too much in our jobs, so much busyness. You know, sometimes it's a sense of not being good enough. No matter how much I do, it's not enough. I need to do more. Perhaps we have the external forces telling us we have to work more. So many jobs are kind of built into that. It's part of the framework of that. But sometimes it's what we bring to the job. It's what we add to that. Those patterns of overwork, not being able to set aside. You know, you can maybe look at your vacation time and how much have you used that. So just like with conflict, the knack of investigation is to switch from the content, from the details of why I'm so stressed. Why is that? You know, why do I keep having to deal with this, to the experience in the body? So really what we're doing is we're switching from the details to the process. If we learn the process, then all the details take care of themselves. Trying to fix the details is endless. There's always going to be more details. Always going to be something that's not going to be quite right. More to do. More to struggle with. But starting to get a hold of the process, then that changes the whole equation. Changes the whole framework. So switching from the details of the stress, my to-do list, that pressure, to the actual sense of the body. If we don't do that, we're lost in the stress. We're acting from it. Of course, sometimes we're so busy, we say, I don't have time to do this, right? The stress is so, the work is so oppressive. So as we come into the body, the question here is to start to notice what kind of person, what type of person am I becoming? Okay, what I mean by that is when we're under stress or any kind of circumstance, there's a certain sense of self that arises with that. In order to be stressed, in order to do this, you know, whether it's being playing or being joyful or being stressed and overworked, there's a way that we form into a sense of me. So if you let go of that sense of what you have to do, and just notice the sense of person that feels like they have to do that. I don't know if that makes sense yet. That sense of the driven person, the perfectionist, the person afraid of being criticized, the one who has ambition. And as you start to relate to this as a state, not as a statement of who you are. So if we take that as being true, then of course I've got to work hard, I've got to be stressed, I have to be worried about this. But if we can start to see that that's a sense of me that I've created around that, and that's all that is, it's just a thought. It's just a thought that I've believed in. If I start to hold it more lightly, then suddenly I see it, there's a freedom that comes from that. There's a freedom from not seeing it as me, but just as a state that's formed around this condition. Now, the stronger the belief around that, the stronger the identification, like I am this kind of a person, the more we have to emphasize the body. The stronger the thoughts are, the stronger we believe in the thoughts, the more we have to counteract that with being embodied. We have to release the story and come back into the sense of embodiment, the body awareness. So this is another aspect of Tanha, that sense of becoming, of wanting to be a certain way. Or the opposite, not wanting to be that certain way. That deep thirst to become, to form, to have a certain self. And we can start to see also what is being denied, you know, the arrogance, the pride. Now the tricky thing about this, if you start to really do this, you start to really see with clearly how you form around this particular work, this situation, you may realize that you're in quite a mess. you've got into this job that really likes that you're obsessive and a perfectionist and stressed out. It likes that. The work pays you more for that, right? And so when you see it clearly, you're kind of, you may have the clarity, but you may still have this big set of conditions you have to navigate through, have to work through. Because, you know, that work, you chose that work because of how it resonated with you. Right? How it resonated with that, how you are. Just like in a relationship, we often pick someone who resonates with some of our most deep wounding, our most unmet aspects. We try to fulfill that with the other person. The same thing with work. We may pick a kind of work or a line of work or a job or a boss that fits that pattern there. That pattern starts to fade and fall away. We still have the work we have to show up at each day. And so sometimes it becomes not a good fit. It doesn't fit so much anymore. But whatever decision comes forth, it comes from a place of clarity, of seeing clearly. Because often you can be in the midst of a work and you can really transform it. You can transform it by how your sense of clarity, your sense of engagement with that. You know, how much do you get caught in the stress and the worry? And perhaps not. Perhaps it's time to change. So this aspect, I don't know if I've explained it well enough. If you think for a moment what work you do, or what you do in your life, you know, whether you're caring for yourself or a loved one or the household, or if you're retired and you're involved in volunteering or oil painting or whatever it might be, pause for a moment and just notice as you think of yourself doing that job, that role, there's a sense of you that arises with that. You know, when you have to kind of step into that role as a teacher, as a whatever it might be. Right? That's what I'm talking about, this role that you've kind of formed around that. Now, if that job is stressful or difficult, there's an aspect of how you meet that, how you form around that. Now, if you can soften the idea, what you have to do in that role, to the sense of being in that role, it's like putting on a certain clothes. If I was a firefighter, I'd put on a jumpsuit. If I was, you know, a doctor, I put on that. If I was, you know, whatever it might be, I put on a certain outfit, a certain uniform, right? We do the same thing with our sense of self. And if we grip that tightly, if we hold that really tightly, that ties us into that sense of suffering. So the gateway here is to see that sense of self that forms around the work and learning to hold that more lightly. And you see that when you lose that job, when you retire, when something changes and you no longer can do that work, when the child leaves the home and you can no longer care in the same way. There's that absence. And it's often highlighted how invested you were in that. This quality of stress and how it's a gateway into really our identification, our sense of who we take ourselves to be. Now the final one we'll talk about is boredom. Boredom at work. You know, most jobs have an aspect which is a bit boring, a little tedious. Very few jobs are so engaging that we're just in there all the time. Parts we'd rather not do. Filled with dullness, a sense of, you know, watching the clock, how much longer, procrastination, I'm going to put that off. It's similar to when we practice meditation. You know, there's a point where the breath is just like, it's so boring. It's like there's nothing going on with the breath or this body sensation. Why can't I just think about my fantasy for a little bit, or can I escape? Right? So we learn through meditation practice, as we deepen into it, to start to be attentive to the breath in a way that's enlivening, that's filled with curiosity, that each breath is very rich and very full. Right? But it takes a while to get that. We have to train ourselves to go through those wells of doubt, of boredom, to actually connect with that experience. And so too with our jobs, when something arises we have to do work that's boring and we just say, oh, not that again, can we find a way to engage with it, to be alive in the midst of that? Going back to the Four Noble Truths, to the sense of tanha, this is often the sense of thirst for sense pleasure, for something that's more enticing, more exciting, more interesting, right? Instead of this repetitive task I have to keep doing. But learning how to find, where can I find that joy in doing a job well? Where can I find that sense of pleasure of really engaging with just that simple sense of cleaning? How can you make that come alive? If we don't attend to the quality of boredom, if we kind of ignore that or try to muscle through it, then it comes back with a vengeance. Right? We kind of create this sense of tension in our psyche. right? Just like with the breath, if you try to force yourself to be on the breath, there's a tension that starts to develop in the meditation. Instead, if we can have this quality, okay, let me open to the sense of boredom. Where is this boredom felt as a body experience? Where is it felt like, you know, in behind the eyes, in the mind, in the heart? Okay, and then suddenly it starts to become more interesting. We start to engage with it in a different way. A sense of boredom, often in classically in Dharma and meditation instructions, boredom is a sign of not paying close enough attention. The closer attention we pay, suddenly there's a sense of curiosity that comes with that. Sometimes we can't pay attention, we're forcing that, so we have to learn how to find an inroad into that. So these three aspects of conflict that arises, how that shows a gateway into our a sense of identification, the sense of being overworked and the stress, how that's a sense of who we are showing up in there. And the boredom, this lack of attention and how that can start to engage. These all become gateways into the Four Noble Truths, a way that we can actually see that operating in our very daily lives. So then our lives become a spiritual practice, not going to the monastery, not going away, but actually learning to meet this very livelihood, this very life as a spiritual practice. All right, let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. Letting those words settle. In a moment or two, we're open to any questions or comments. Just noticing what in the talk and the topic stuck, felt resonant, or perhaps felt like it didn't resonate, a sense of argument with it, a sense of understanding, not understanding, or disagreement. Place of confusion. And seeing if a question or a comment can form around that. And first I'd like to just say a few words about the practice and reflection over by the Dana basket. There should be a piece of paper for you. So this is a way to take the topic into the next week to see how can you engage with it. And so the three aspects, the conflict at work, this practicing of shifting the focus from the details of the conflict into the body. And as you connect with the body and relax with the body, allow it to soften, to see what is being denied in this moment. This provides a place of clarity. And from that place of clarity, then we act. Then we speak. Then with stress, shifting from this content of the situation to that sense of you that forms in that area, that being stressed, that being overworked. The sense of you that's out of control. The you that needs approval. The you that's consumed with worry. And start to see this is not who you are, but simply a shape that you're assuming. Just a clothing that you're putting on. And then finally for boredom, notice the body's experience in relationship to boredom. Where is boredom felt in the body? Where does it reside? And challenge yourself to engage with some aspect of a task. How can I find a place of aliveness, of curiosity with this? And notice if paying more attention may spark curiosity and aliveness. All right, so we have a chance for any comments or questions. Yes, Sarah Lee. Yes.
It feels like a space in between activity, whether it's cognitive, emotional, physical, or whatever. And the association I'm making, because of what you're saying about using it as an entree, an entrance into Dharma, that thinking of when you're thinking and you're not, and then there's a space. And that is an opportunity to drop to a different consciousness. I can't help wondering how boredom might fit into that analogy.
Okay. Great, yes. No, that's a great, it's very clear, it's a nice question. I'm just going to try to paraphrase it for the recording. So working with boredom and the sense of it being a space between activity, whether it's thought or action or, you know, motion, and that sense of how do you work with that space as making that an entry point? Is that essentially it? Yes.
That is the entrance to another level of consciousness.
Yes, yes. Yes, so this sense of space between thoughts and how that can actually be an entry to a different level of consciousness. Yeah, the sense of space between whatever, right? Instead of that being boring or boredom, because there's not much happening, but there's also a sense of peace. There's a sense of deep contentment, there's a deep sense of stillness. So then it comes to this sense of how do we relate to that stillness? You know, we have a sense of holding that away, trying to, you know, I want something to stimulate, something to engage with, something to do, versus surrendering to that stillness. Because that's that space between is actually showing you more the bedrock of experience. Right, there's a sense of background stillness, a background, I got in trouble for saying this the other day, emptiness, right? Right? There's a sense of emptiness, and things arise from that, into that. And we're usually so focused on the things that are arising, I like that or don't like that or want more of that. But as that naturally quiets down and there's nothing arising, you know, that right in there, there shows you that quality of tanha and that quality of, okay, I have this thirst to become, thirst to have something to think about, something to grapple with or to fantasize about. But if I release that quality of tanha, if I don't engage with it, then we're starting to have that sensation, that blowing out, the nibbana, starting to come into that moment, that sense of releasing of that urge to be. Right? And so if you can start to relax with that, sometimes that relaxation, there's also fear that comes. You know, if I'm not doing something, who am I? Who's running this show? What's my role in life if I'm not engaging in that way? Right? And as that arises, that's even more of a cue to relax into it. To say, okay. It's just the stillness. And so it's really a reorientation of instead of orienting around those ideas and concepts and things we do to the space that they arise from, and which is more primary, the space around or the actual objects.
You can make people curious.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, how to be curious about boredom? It's simply, I mean, one thing is like it's not comfortable. It's not fun to be bored, right? So it's a difficult experience. Why not transform it? Why not? Yes. Yeah, exactly. This.
It's not in and of itself experience.
Yes, exactly.
It's a
yeah.
Valence, so as a result, that's where it's no longer boredom.
Right. Yeah, so she's, again, for the tape, that you're saying that that space, your, the valence, is that that is boredom. But that's something that you're adding to. That's the way you're interpreting that space. And when you drop the interpretation, then there's something that's very mysterious, very alive, very full in that absence. Yeah, thank you. Yes, Anna.
Hi, thanks, Tim. I had a little story a couple of years ago. I was on retreat, and this has to do with what you said about stress. And my quote-unquote job, I had an extra job, which was serving a blind yogi every one of his meals. So I would choose from this elaborate selection of foods. I had no idea what his preferences were. And I would get stressed out. I mean, I obsess about my own food, but it was like triple to obsess about what this guy was gonna eat. So I would be getting, lunchtime would be coming or breakfast time, and I would get really stressed. And I could totally feel it in my body. Yogi mm-hmm. mind was happening, so mm-hmm. I was concentrated. And I was telling my teacher about this, and he just said something that went right in, which was something like, it's just what like Sarah Lee just said about boredom is kind of invented by the system. It doesn't exist. You can't go out and get boredom. And he said, you know, the Buddha would not be stressed about this. Something like, it's the animus, it's the self-image that I'm bringing to the situation. Mm-hmm. It's what does it say about me? That was causing all that stress. I need to do this right. He needs to be happy and nourished, of course. And so then the next time I got in line after this conversation with the teacher, I was standing in the lunch line and I was like, okay, what's actually really happening? Nothing was happening. I was adding all the stress. There's people standing quietly in the line is what was happening. And I just had this huge insight around, I'm creating this whole situation. The record does not show any stress happening, but it's happening because I am not at ease with the situation. And someone with more wisdom would have been. And somehow the teacher really helped me to see that. And it was a turning point in my like perfectionism and thinking I have to do it all for everyone. And I got a lot of relief from that. So I hope that's helpful for people.
Yeah, beautiful. So just to paraphrase that for the recording, being a yogi on retreat and having a yogi job of tending to a blind person and getting their food for them and offering it to them, and the stress about them, you picking the right food, and is it going to be nourishing, are they going to like it, and all this, you know, wanting to perform and be perfect in this role, and a teacher saying that the Buddha would not be stressed about this, and that, you know, bringing that to light, that quality of what is being added to this. Yeah, beautiful. And that's really the, you know, a nice way of describing this whole process, is that we're adding this unnecessary suffering, this unnecessary stress to this moment, right? And though our work provides countless, you know, opportunities to see what we add to that. And how do we work with that? How do we start to tease that apart? You know, coming into the body, as we talked about in the talk, or that reflecting that, you know, how would Buddha hold this? You know, how would someone with great wisdom hold this? And you can see what is being added onto. And in that seeing of what's being added onto, yeah, there's a freedom, just as you notice. There's nothing that needs to be done differently. Yes.
Before I can feel present, you know, do this creative work. And so I have strategies. in order to get to a place where I feel connected, released, joyful about what I'm doing. And this isn't so much a question as could you talk a little bit more?
Sure. So the framing of the comment or question is having a job where there's a studio go into, and you said that there's like a minefield of selves that you have to kind of navigate through and find a way to work through that to the point where there's a creativity arises, where you feel connected and able to have the creative quality arise. And how do you work with that? Is that, yeah. So I like the phrasing of that, and you know, anyone who's had to create, it's hard to do it on demand. Like sometimes doing a talk, I've learned not to force it, you know, to wait till it's just starting to emerge. And then it's quite joyful. But sometimes, you know, the timing of the talk doesn't correspond with that. So you have to have ways to get that to go up. So what I would suggest is, You said that you have to do kind of these different activities, these strategies, so you can feel connected, right? So what about connecting with the disconnection? You know, I'm going to connect with all those minefields. Instead of learning to navigate them and build bridges over them and, you know, run around them, let me just meet them and just say, okay, let me really open to this. This is the moment. This is what's arising in the moment. If the goal is to connect, connecting with that will probably actually provide this wellspring of a different quality of creativity.
Yeah, I'm realizing that the reason I don't is because those are fearful.
Yeah.
And, of course, thank
you. Well, that's really important to acknowledge that why we don't connect is because they're fearful or painful, or they just have a lot of charge, you know. And so we all have certain level of things we just don't want to go into because they're just so painful. Some of us have things which are very significantly painful, you know. So how do we learn to work with that? And that's why the body is such a beautiful metaphor for how to work with it. Really a deep process to work with it. Because we try to go up from our mind and from our ideas of trying to fix it and navigate it, we get very kind of battered by the breeze and by the gales. But we say, focus on just relaxing the body, providing a sense of verticality, a sense of, let's let this be felt, let this drain through the body. And just kind of doing that as a general practice. And then when one of those painful things come up, can I feel that as a body experience? Because it will be in the body. It will be there. And then the work is not to try to figure it out cognitively, emotionally, or mentally, but to let the body start to soften around it. And that starts to create space, you know, for the mind to start to be able to work with it and understand it. And it's very helpful to float this question, you know, what is being denied? What am I not allowing in this moment? Not the question to say, okay, then I need to allow it. I need to stop denying it. But just to notice, what am I denying? All right? And then just by noticing that and saying, okay, I feel that as a mirror in the body. Can I start to work to relax this? And that might be a process of months, of years, as you work with some of the deeper ones. But that sense of acknowledging. So your mind, your whole mind becomes something that there's nothing that's unknown in it. That everything is known, everything is welcomed. And then from that place, then creativity is just a natural state. Thank you. Yes. Right.
And then in changing your interactions with your patients or your colleagues that I work with. And so even with the meditation practice that I do daily, I still feel that's consistently there. And it's just very general. It's very confusing. It kind of manifested in bodily stresses as well. You're sitting in hurts more. There's just odd things that happen. So, and then even
Okay. So the question is around kind of a almost a background discontent, a sense of unease that comes forth throughout work, and even, you know, meditating with it and being still with it and investigating it still continues, and not quite sure where it's coming from. It seems to be kind of amorphous, but same time very prevalent. And how do you work with that? Is that, yeah. So, kind of inherent in the question is the sense of that being, it shouldn't be there. Right, so there's a sense, I'm gonna open to this as fully as I can on the condition that it's gonna get out of here, right? I'm gonna look at this, but I'm letting go as I'm letting go of it, you know, as I'm looking at it. So that sense of patience and that sense of not actually relaxing the need to figure it out. Because the trying to figure it out is kind of laced with the aversion to it, the sense of not liking it, not wanting it, right? So then, it's like if you had a shy little kitten, you're trying to, you know, tame it, a feral cat, you know, you can't, like, you have to just entice it over. You can't, like, chase it, try to chase it into your apartment or whatever it is. You have to be much more welcoming around that. So start to kind of relax the need to figure it out, to fix it, and to get rid of it. And just say, okay, let me feel this as an experience. Come back into the body, let the body relax around it, soften around it as much as best you can. So there's a sense of letting it drain out, letting it relax. And so there's, you kind of soften that need to try to fix, to try to get rid of, to understand. That paradoxically provides the conditions for you to understand it much more deeply. But because there's a sense of pushing it away, not liking it, a sense of aversion, there's a core aspect that's being hidden. But the more you can open to it and welcome it without the agenda of getting rid of it, then it will start to show itself. And sometimes it's almost like a habit, you know, that still has to work its way through the system. You know, sometimes I wake up and I just feel this sense of kind of ill at ease, a sense of generalized, you know, just mild kind of, it's not really anxiety, but just like a little bit of that. And I'm like, okay, you know, what am I worried about? What's going on? And often there's no answer to that. But say, okay, let me go into the body. Let me really welcome this experience as a body experience. Relaxing as much as I can, as best I can, any tension, any resistance around that. Right? And then see what happens. And I think that will help clarify it. And then you, as you do that, you find that there's maybe some deeper beliefs, deeper ideas about yourself that arises with that. Because really what we're doing is we're going through the fog. We're going through the darkness and the fog, and it's hazy, and we can't really see things, and our flashlight's not very bright. And we have to just kind of trust that the process will start to take care of itself. That as we practice, especially in the way we just described, the fog will start to lift and there'll be clarity that starts to rise. Yes, Rob.
I'm a little bit confused by that. I mean, is another way of saying that just, what am I not accepting?
So the question is around, with conflict or stress, to ask, you know, what am I denying? And there's some confusion about that. And you, and was it felt, you said, is that another form of...
I mean, I'm guessing there's other ways of phrasing that question.
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of ways to phrase it. You know, the language, you have to find your entry into it. But you're forgetting the key step of going into the body. All right, so I said it in a few seconds, but the actual process may be a few days or a few weeks. or a few months, depending on the intensity of something. So the conflict, so basically we're learning how to, you know, it's like we can almost say there's this choice of thought, idea, emotion, all those things, versus body, right? So it's in some ways we're kind of making an artificial separation, because the mind tends to have such a, I hate to use this word, but tends to trump the body, right? It tends to go into, it overpowers the body's knowing. So we have to re-emphasize the body. We have to rediscover the wisdom of the body. And so when you're in a conflict, come into that sense of being embodied with it, really feeling it as deeply as you can, with as little resistance as you can. Saying, can I open to this? What in the body am I resisting? What am I not allowing? And allow that to become this bedrock. So it might be a process that, you know, takes a while, right? And then after it feels like, okay, I can feel this conflict arise, that pit in my stomach, I can relax with it, I can feel in the body, then you ask that question, you know, what is not being allowed? What is not accepted? What is outside of my heart? What is denied? What am I not accepting? Different ways of phrasing that same question. What am I wishing wasn't here? Does that make sense? That, okay, yes. What am I wishing wasn't here? Okay, and you just feel that, as again, mostly in the body. If you get caught in the story around it, then it's kind of like it's a rabbit hole of, you know, you get lost in that. So come back into that, the embodiment of that. Because when the body touches it, when the body feels it, there's a clarity with that. There's a truth and a stillness. Again, remember, when you touch into something still, something true, there would be a stillness that arises from that. If it adds more confusion, you're not quite going the right way. But remember, you know, we're walking around in the fog, so be patient. Yes. Yes, nice. So the comment is that phrase, bare knowing. And that phrase of bare knowing, or sometimes you say bare attention, it's what is it bare of? Is there opinions or resistance or idea of it? And there's just this, there's no distance between what is knowing, what is the known, and what is knowing it. And that's really the ultimate, as we start to have that distance gets more and more close. Often something arises and there's a lot of judgment, a lot of opinionation, a lot of resistance to it, this shouldn't be here. And learning to acknowledge that, that distance starts to become closer and closer back to that bare knowing. Yeah. And the practice has these almost two modes or wings. One is the quality of orienting toward that bare knowing. So that becomes the orienting factor. We start to listen for that more and more. And that's where I surrender, that's where I trust. The other quality is notice what I make unbare, what do I add to it, and making that an object of investigation in order to find the deeper stillness underneath. Yeah, thank you. Yes.
A bunch of my resistance and arguing, and I try to practice that on a regular basis when I'm caught up in my thoughts. I love that balloon analogy. It feels like all these thought bubbles are totally tangled up with each other. So I just wanted to share that phrase, I consent. I consent to whatever's happening right now inside me, in my body, around me, my emotions, my body sensations.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. So the phrase, I consent, you know, taking that from Tara Brach's teaching, and that I consent to this experience, this mind, this thought, this body, this situation. And that's, you know, coming back to like that bare attention, that non-resistance. See, the language, it's really different words resonate in different ways for us. And so it's, you know, find what works. And if a teacher offers something that really resonates, then go with that. And if at some point it doesn't, then find something else. And just, the point is that you orient to what's working. And sometimes we lose our way and we have to rediscover a new way. And that's wonderful to have those phrases, like the bare attention, the bare knowing, you know, I consent, you know, saying yes. All right, anyone else have any comments or questions they'd like to share? Yes. Mm-hmm. So the comment was on the sense of identity at work, and that the parts that were really enforced at work are what is called forth in work. Is that, yeah? And that's, I think in some ways that's kind of the object of it, is we kind of come into the situation, whether it's at work or in a relationship or in a conflict, with as clean a slate as we can. And then we arise, what arises is what is needed in that, right? Then we arise with that, we can meet that. And then when that's no longer needed, then we let it go. The trouble is when we, you know, oh, I like that one, I'm gonna hang on to that one. It's like, hey, do you know I'm a such and such? You know, there's that sense of identification, and then we feel that sense of someone not acknowledging that, or sense of disrespect, and we can feel the suffering. I mean, that it's suffering in that moment. But if we're able to have that sense of freedom of, I arise when I need to, and then that falls away. Then our lives are fluid. We can meet the circumstances, the situation, as it's needed. And when that situation is no longer there, then we fall back into stillness. Yeah, that's the benefit of the work. So our life becomes one of spontaneity and of appropriateness. It meets this circumstance. So sometimes it looks very powerful, very forceful. Sometimes it looks very gentle, very peaceful. But we're not identified in any part of that. Yes?
Could you comment a little bit on the role of like aversion and clinging at work? So if you cling to your role, who you think you are, mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. So the comment or question is around clinging and aversion around work, and how there's aspects you may cling to and other parts you may deny, and how that takes place at work. And certainly, you know, depending on our job, sometimes some are more reinforced. Like the last comment is some, you know, there's aspects of you that work better at work than others. It's that sense of how do we know when we're clinging? How do we know when we're averse? Is when we have that strong preference. You can often see when it falls away, when it's no longer there, there's a sense of kind of chasing it. Oh, I want that to stay, then there's clinging. If there's a sense of relief when that's passed away, then aversion has arisen. So, but we have to really acknowledge the whole process. You know, treat it as not like if I was a better meditator, was a better student, then I wouldn't have craving or aversion, clinging, arise, but more of a sense of, wow, this is like a custom-built spiritual practice for me. You know, I can see really, you know, real time how I crave, how I cling, how I am averse. And if you get over the natural human, almost built into our our minds and are hardwired into us to judge, to want to fix, to want to say this is good and this is bad. If you can soften that enough so we can actually see, can actually understand what's present, then when clinging arises, instead of like, oh, I shouldn't be clinging, it's more like, oh, let me feel this quality of clinging. And in that clarity of seeing, the fog starts to lift. Same thing with aversion. Let me really open to that. Let me befriend that. Now, befriending is not the same as acting from. I think that's an important aspect. And that's really why this whole section of the Eightfold Path is in the action section, is like how we act does matter. But how we meet the moment experience, how we open to that, that's that full, you know, embodiment, full opening to that. But then how we act from that, that does, you know, we don't engage more with the clinging because that reinforces it. We don't re-engage with the aversion because that reinforces it. So we have to be patient. You know, it's like we may find ourselves, I've already typed that email and sent it, and I'm like, oh no. Okay, then you feel that. You feel the echoes of that. Right? And as you do that more and more, you catch it earlier on in the process. And don't forget to apply it to your internal self. The parts you crave, the parts you cling to, the parts you reverse to. Yes.
Relating to stress, I feel like during the day I'm able to notice that, but at night when I like wake up in the middle of the night and my mind is turning, it just cannot, it's really hard for me to get into the body and notice the stress. I just keep reacting to it and I can't sleep.
So the comment is on stress, and like during the daytime you can kind of work with it, but at nighttime, like in the middle of the night when it wakes you up, it's just so gripping, it's really hard to release and hard to work with that. So, you know, practice this sense of almost visualization that as you're laying in bed, just keep coming back into the body. Imagine the body just draining, like it's just draining into the bed, into the earth. You're just letting any areas of tension start to release. Okay, as the stress arises around that particular situation, that experience, okay, let me feel that as a body experience and start to let that relax, start to let that drain. So that's why I think the body is so helpful, because in, you know, the nighttime, you know, the mind is more active. It kind of, we're not so alert, but it, you know, paradoxically becomes stronger. So if you can learn, okay, let me feel this, let me really focus on this body, kind of relax, let the body release.
I just feel like my aversion to being awake in the first place is helping.
Yeah. Yeah, so the aversion to being awake in the middle of the night when you should be sleeping, yeah, it doesn't help. Yeah, we become more and more tense. So try to catch it as soon as you can. You wake up at that moment, oh, I don't want to be, I should be asleep. Okay, right then, come back into the body. So it takes a while to really train yourself, but it can be very helpful. And you can use, you know, different images. You can have this sense of things floating away, you know, evaporating off you, if that makes more sense. So using the body as a template. Yes, last question. Okay, so the comment or question is how dukkha, stress can certainly magnify kind of dukkha, but also stress can perhaps motivate or increase more positive aspects. Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. That certainly, depending on how we're holding it, the way that we're identifying with it, the more identified we are with it, the more likely it's going to be that destructive quality, right? But other kinds of stress can be that sense of energy, that sense of alignment, that okay, I really have to show up, I really want to engage with that. And those ones have a different quality if you look at the body. There's a sense of contraction, a sense of tightening with the first one, and the latter one there's a sense of you know, it's going beyond the known, it's going beyond, like when you're really creative, for example, that sense of energy. Or when you're sitting, you know, on a retreat and you're just, there's the energy moving through the body and there's just such an alertness to want to pay attention. You know, so it's, and ideally we start to transform stress, all kinds of stress, more and more into that one that leads to enlivenment. All right. So thank you for your heartfelt questions and the engagement. It really helps the talk flesh out and meet your needs as Dharma practitioners. So I will be here next week. We'll be opening to wise action, do discussion the week after that. Carrie will do a subbing for me when I'm teaching at IMS. Then I'll be back in August, the last week in August. Actually, Twer will be here too. We'll be doing the forgiveness ceremony the last Tuesday in August. All right, there's homework backed by the Dharma baskets. Have a great evening.